This is Comcast Radio, and I'm Deanie Petty, in conversation with, how do I introduce this man to you? I met this man 4.5 years ago. When I met him and watched him and listened to him for a while, I thought, he's a New York Jewish gay man, a publicist who's been in the business for years, very witty, very quick thinking, obviously very intelligent. I ought to get to know this man. And here we are 4.5 years later, and I did get to know you, Mr. Stephen Adler.
You did. And I got to know you. Compliments. It's all the burden, but it's compliments.
One of the things about you that, and I know people have told you this, and I know your reaction, it was your sister, I believe, who said it to you about how intelligent you are. And you were like, what? You had no idea. None.
No.
If you had to describe yourself to somebody, what would you say about yourself?
Funny. Don't take myself seriously. Want to know all about everybody else. And pretty average.
Stephen Adler worked as a publicist for most of his life.
Yes.
And you were born where?
New York City.
New York City. So, what was your first big job in the business, in show business, Stephen?
Johnson. Somebody phoned me up after graduation and said, gee, there's two jobs. One is in advertising, and the other is in Johnson. Are you interested? I said, sure. And I took down both addresses. Didn't know where the agency was, so I thought, I'll open the symphony.
Because I know where it is.
I know where it is. And how to get there. And I got on the subway. So I think, oh my God, I don't know anything about classical music. I've never been to a concert. What will I do? Oh, I know Leonard Bernstein. Yeah, people's concerts, I can talk about him. And I was the only one out of 100 and some odd that didn't care about concerts.
What did you care about?
Publicizing, selling tickets, marketing.
How long were you with the Toronto Symphony?
8 years.
Okay, and when you left, there were some benchmarks made.
Yes.
And they were?
We had more subscribers than the Maple Leafs.
Wait a minute, a lot of people go, well, I know he went to the Maple Leafs, but this was in the, what year are we in back there?
Late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
We have 37,000 subscribers.
Wow.
I don't take all the credit at all. I don't. What I do say is that we determined that it was perceived as very too sophisticated, too snobby, too waspy. How do we change that? Well, you can do it by visually. No more pictures and tuxedos and long gowns, lots of jeans, lots of comfort, and that was it. Other than the official photograph of the orchestra, no other photos were allowed to show anything other than average people doing average things. After 3 years, we did that, and it made a huge impact.
That's really interesting. You brought it down from that level down to, like, accessible to
very accessible. And then we did things like in advertising, because I didn't know anything about the music either. I wrote silly things like, when we had the Messiah, I didn't know what it was. So I went into my boss's office, I put the Messiah, and he said, of course you know. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Oh, yeah. And I wrote back, wrote the ad. Yeah, I said, the greatest hallelujah chorus of all time, the Messiah, don't miss it. Sold out.
What? Anybody who, you know, is listening, who's in associated with the business or has a business, realizes that publicity and getting it out there is like the key. It's so key. And you've been a publicist how many years?
4,311. Publicity to me is publicity. It's marketing, packaging, it's everything. The marketer will say that publicity is a tool of marketing, and marketers will say that. Publicists will say the reverse. I don't care. I do not differentiate anything.
So give me some tips, or anybody, about if you I mean, you took the Toronto Symphony to like 37,000 subscribers. Do you remember what it was at when you got there? 23,000. So you went, that's a lot. So if you want to give somebody advice about publicity, what advice could you give somebody?
Publicity, what I learned when I started, was the relationship you had with the media. And the relationship you had with the media was precious. So I would trust them and tell them things that off the record. And slowly they got to trust me. So if I needed something, I could get it.
So building relationships, particularly with the people, the media, whatever form you're dealing with. You weren't born in Toronto.
No.
Where?
New York. New York, New York. The flower of Fifth Avenue Hospital. Sounds very positive.
The flower of Fifth Avenue Hospital.
Was Fifth and 123rd Street. And it was called the Flower Hospital. Just like Saks. The only Saks in the world that's not called Saks Fifth Avenue is the one on Fifth Avenue. Just called Saks and Company. This was the Flower Hospital, which closed down and moved to Westchester.
What year were you born?
1947.
Okay, so, young Jewish man born at the Flower Hospital discovers at what age, oh my God, I'm gay.
Well, I didn't even know what gay was. I just knew that I wasn't all that attracted to women. Other than his friends. I didn't know that there was something different. And as things changed, I began to realize. So I guess by 14, 15, I realized that I had no interest the same way other male friends did in them.
So at 14 or 15, if you're 47, that's 50, like you're in the 60s, plus you're from a Jewish family, and that's got to be a little difficult. Well, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how hard was it?
A very unusual Jewish family in the sense that my great grandparents were alive. I knew my great grandmother very well. So there were several generations of us already. We were just brand new. And the two never were discussed at the same time. I got a Jewish education,
right?
And it had nothing to do with sex. It was only the Orthodox Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, that were opposed to gay sex.
Okay.
My family wasn't. But I wasn't about to tell them that that's what I was more interested in. But I think they knew. I remember recently thinking about how they have known. A simple thing like I said to my mother many times, you should dye your hair silver blonde like the Gabors because you're just as beautiful as they are. Now, what straight kid of age 10 or 11 would tell their mother what color hair to have?
So you were very into fashion and is that what I'm assuming?
No.
Or, okay, you were...
I was into fashion, but very visual. Noticed everything. And made the connection to either that's pretty, I can make her pretty by telling her to do that. And that's what, and then everything in my house had to have dimmer switches. This is my family's house. And I would run around taking dimmer switches up, and nobody could understand it. I just thought, so much nicer.
Yeah, yeah. So you ended up in New York City when?
And that's when I was born.
No, but I thought you went to Toronto. Yeah.
Yeah. The Toronto Symphony, well, I did a good job with them, so. I was getting calls from Carnegie Hall and from a publicist across the street, P. Arthur. And that was late 70s, early 80s, after the China trip. Toronto Symphony was the first symphony to go to China. We were the ambassadors because of Nixon starting an agreement. But the United States didn't even have an embassy there. So Canada was a cultural connection.
So after this trip, you start getting, you got a call from Carnegie Hall. That's
yes.
big.
Well, it was, but I knew them because we, every year or so, the symphony would go to Carnegie Hall and play. And I would always go down in advance and set up some interviews and do whatever I could and make sure our tune sheet was proper and looked good and all the materials were good and develop more relationships.
So who did you go to work for?
Not Carnegie Hall.
Why not?
Because the woman that was running it said, go over across the street to Kirby and Bird, you're going to have much more fun. I can't pay you as much. Step forward, I'll hire you. They would never make that offer. So I went to Burton and Bertha, and they were a PR firm that handled classical music and theater and a lot of other people. One of my first clients from them was Victor Borga.
Oh.
And I had to go with him to Washington, D.C. to reopen or to reopen the temporary Wolf Trap summer facility for the National Orchestra in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Theirs had burnt down, so they bought a tent. And I had to go with Victor, and he was right. He was exactly like.
As he was on stage?
Exactly. And funnier. His first words to me were, your zip is open. I said, really? And I felt it. That's nonsense. At least you pay attention. And that broke the ice, and then I was fine. His assistant was Jim. He cleared everything through Jim, and Victor would do almost everything of the sequence.
I know you met some famous people along the way, but I know that you became very good friends with an icon that there's so many people who just revered and loved this woman because they all dreamed of Jeannie.
Yes.
Barbara Eden.
Yes.
And you were like very close friends.
Yes. My cousin David Herr.
Ah.
And he plastic surgeon to the stars.
Ah.
And but Barbara and I developed our own friendship. And she is and was great. She was fantastic and fun. Still.
Because you worked with so many big stars, like we're talking really big names, like Victor Borga, Barbara, Eden, did you find that most of the really big names you worked with were like decent, good, hard-working people?
Yes, almost without exception. It was the ones that never quite made it that were very difficult.
And why do you think that is?
Because they never made it. They played everybody but themselves.
Bitterness is the word we're looking for.
Yeah. And they were difficult. I remember once setting up the opening of Union Station in Washington, D.C. I was working on a show called Sophisticated Ladies, and I had convinced the entire company to do a song and dance. And the whole company got out there, costume change and all that stuff cost a lot of money, only to discover they couldn't tap dance because the stage was padded. Now what do I do? I do remember starting to smoke again, that incident. And nobody complained of the stars. They worked their way around it. Two or three, the very bottom of the rung, who accused me of everything stupid, how did you be so stupid, and refused to go on. And I remember Dee Dee Bridgewater was the in that particular show, and she said, screw up, we don't need it. And that's the way it was.
You also told me once, and I remember this, that when you went to New York and you worked there, it was the first time that you were amongst like kind, mm-hmm. gay, Jewish yeah. men, brilliant, hardworking, and that must have
shocked me.
Shocked?
Well, pleased me. It shocked me that there were so many, but it pleased me because I felt very comfortable. First time in my life, totally.
Wow.
Because you could be gay funny and Jewish funny at the same time.
Oh my God, that's hysterically funny.
Again, both.
Yeah.
Wow. I get to that. To use a Jewish expression to another gay man, I didn't have to do that. And, but funny enough, they got it. And that caused even a closer bond.
I know there's a story about how you knew your family knew, and it was to do with your grandmother.
Yes. She when I come back for a visit or sitting around, she said, "So when are you going to bring a nice boy home for us to meet?"
Were you taken aback?
Very far, far back. And I think this happened because her youngest sister declared about a year earlier, and her youngest sister was 40 years younger than she, declared that she was gay. And if she could be gay, then that was okay. It was just becoming okay to be gay. So she mentioned it.
I was wondering, because it was a, did you ever talk to your parents directly about it, or was it just accepted and we went forward? Did we ever have a moment where,
years later, my father and I never, I knew instinctively he was having huge problems with it. But my father came from Brooklyn. My father's best friend was Johnny Bonanno.
The Johnny Bonanno?
Oh, yes.
Like a mafioso guy?
Yeah. And that was his world.
Wait a minute, what did your father do that he had friends like Johnny Bonanno?
He was a man in fact, because they lived in the same
neighborhood. Ah, okay.
That's where they grew up.
Ah.
So, I don't think he knew what to make of it. I don't think he ever knew what gay was.
Okay.
So, what was this peculiar kid doing?
How long did you stay in New York?
15 years,
I think. And were you working for that same agency whose name was so odd? Was it even that advertising?
Gertman and Murtha.
Gertman and Murtha.
Yeah, an Irishman and a Jew. And they were great. They were fun.
You were with them the whole 15 years?
No. At one point, one of the producers I was working for sort of sub-hired me away. And I did all of their shows, which was fun.
I remember you telling me a story, and it's a publicity stunt, but you had something drawn on a sidewalk, a huge chalk drawing. What was that about?
That was Joseph, an amazing Technicolor green coat, and it was in Boston. And in Boston, there was a thing called a crossing, which is between Filings and Jordan Marsh, that's Chicago, the two great department stores. And they both faced there. That was the most traveled area in Boston. So I found this sidewalk drawer and asked him if he could do it.
Artist drawer,
yeah, thank you. See how smart? Anyway, he did, and the news people came to take pictures of it.
And it was it the Technicolor?
Oh yeah, it was pretty much the logo of the show, but in all the colors.
And how big was this on the, like how big are we talking?
Oh, about 10 feet tall by about 4 feet wide, maybe more.
On the sidewalk.
And people sort of prevented anybody from walking over it. It all happened spontaneously. And word got out and the show sold out. And at that same time, I remember, It was in the political time in the United States, but of course it's always there. Dukakis were from Boston. And I asked Kitty Dukakis if she would model a dream coat that we were going to have made specially to auction off and raise money for kids. She agreed, and we did that. So we made $25,000 that one night for her modeling a green coat that one of the local people made. I would be bored, and I'd come up with ideas in the middle of the night, and that's what we do.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about it's a very creative process. I mean, the idea of putting a chalk drawing that's that huge on a sidewalk, literally in the middle of the night, these things would be like, bingo, I've got it.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any that bingo and it flopped?
Well, it didn't flop, but I'll tell you the story. Art had become a friend to me every year. And I loved his music because I understood it. It wasn't classical. And I found Texaco. I spoke to their PR guy. Could we get the help the hats?
Yeah, the Texaco hats, yeah.
Does a hat for the entire orchestra. And then I got a gold one for him. He was even brought to the forum at Ontario Place by fireboat for a publicity stunt. And when he got there, the fire people presented him with a gold helmet. Fabulous, all that great stuff. Came up, took the podium, did the whole concert, everything was great. During the encore, the entire orchestra leaned over and put their hats on. So we had the entire orchestra, and then he reached down and put his on. Fabulous picture, and it was really good enough work. Sitting in the audience, the VIP section was the sponsor of the night, the orchestra. And it was Esso. And I had all the publicity for Texaco.
Closed but no cigar. Oh dear.
Fortunately, it was extraordinarily kind. And he really loved the symphony. And he just said, please don't put it in.
Wow.
It didn't flop, but it came very close.
Yeah.
I mean, he really could have had it fired.
So you've been backstage of shows that have worked, and you've seen what happens when there's, like, when Technicolor Dreamcoat sells out. But you must have also been there when, like, nobody showed, and it was just...
Yeah.
How do you get people through that? How do people get them... What do you
Most
say?
Of them are professional.
Most of them are professional. Okay.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry that much. You have to make a joke. Equity has a rule, have more people in the audience on stage or you don't have to perform.
I didn't know
that. That's okay if there are a few people on stage, but if there are 40 people on stage, if you don't have 40 in the audience, it's canceled.
I remember interviewing Garth Brooks Garth Brooks, and we were talking about this exact thing, and he said, "Dee, I've shown up at concerts where there was like 3 or 4 people in the audience." I said, "So what did you do?" He said, "I did the best damn concert I could."
Yeah.
I mean, professional. Yeah, and that's really a key word in this business.
Yeah.
Were most of the people you work with, you would say they were professional or would...
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Even the nasty ones were still professional. They wouldn't mind smacking you around as they became professional ones. But... they were professional. They knew what they had to do. Comedy Steamers.
Yes.
I had to fly to Ann Arbor, Michigan to do a photograph for an upcoming show we were doing called I'm Getting My Act Together and Taking It on the Road.
I remember that time.
Uh-huh. And she refused to do the photo. And I said, why is all my hair? I said, I've got the microphone. That's all we need. And I said, I have 3 hours. Finish rehearsal, go take a shower, I'll be here. Blah, I'm not doing it enough. So I told the producer, what do you want me to do? He said, quote, tell her if she doesn't, I will find a picture of a mongoloid and substitute it for hers on all the posters. Guess what? She did it.
You have the advantage now of hindsight at this stage in your life. If you have to do it all over again, and this career that you've had was not there. You can't do that again, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But you could do, and using your hindsight, what would you pick from your scene for yourself?
Psychologist.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what the world needs, is another Jewish psychologist, psychiatrist.
It's fascinating.
What?
The mind, the way people think, the way they react to things. And I hate to say it, I love trying to manipulate without anybody knowing I'm doing it. I didn't even know I was doing it for years.
Oh, I noticed that part.
Oh, yeah. But it's, once you have it, it's easy. And you just
have it. What do you mean, once you have it?
Once you understand that you have this gift to manipulate without upsetting people.
Yeah, which is another way to me of saying to get people to do what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, if you're going to be a publicist, that's got to be number one on your sheet.
Yeah.
You got to be able to do that.
And I didn't know I could. When I was hired, all I had to know how to do was write a press release. But I didn't understand why nobody was writing to say good evening to the critics that were there. I was the first one that started it, and unfortunately, they all sat in three different places in Matthew Hall. The Star sat upstairs, center. The Sun, when I finally got him to come more regularly, and he loved it, sat up one more level, and the Globe and Mail, Tom Craglin, got us and sat right downstairs, center, up. And in 15 minutes, I would visit all three.
How powerful are critics? Do people actually pay that much attention to them? And what do you really think of critics? Are they a necessary force?
One of my best friends is a critic.
Who's that?
Gina Mallet.
Oh, yes.
I'm a friend. And I only worked with her a couple of times, but it's a friend. I admired a man named John. Oh.
John, what's his name?
Who? You know, he was at the Globe. He opened the embassy of the Chinese, when China became accessible, he opened the bureau there.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I love the critics. They were fun.
Are they mostly fair, the critics, or were some of them, did some of them make their reputation by looking for the worst, or were they, how did you
find them? They were very wise.
Because they understood that how crushing and amazed they could be.
Clive Barnes was on Dick Cavett's show once. And the producer who produced 40 Second Street was the guest. Supposed to be fighting with Barnes. And Barnes looked at him and said, have I ever reviewed, in your mind, a great show, gave it a bad review and it closed? And gave me Merrick said, no. So that's my case. I don't have that much power.
Of all the wonderful things you've done in your life, if I asked you for like one of your favorite moments, your favorite memories, where it was just like so perfect, I don't know why I went to the technical or Dream Code, but I did. But
I'll have to come back to that. Okay. Lots. I've been very blessed. And my other big blessing is remembering. I remember so much.
They say that's what old age is for. Life is to do all the things you get to remember.
But I used to remember them when I was younger.
Oh, so you were that old young man.
She once said to me, do you remember what it was like in my womb? As a joke.
I'm an incredibly, extremely good memory.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond most people.
Yes, much that I accept now.
But you didn't know
that. I didn't understand. I thought everything was great. I used to describe what my bedroom looked like in detail when I was 2 years old. So, having that memory of everything.
That's
amazing. That's a joy.
We're going into the era of photographic memory. Is that something that happens in your family?
They call it eidetic.
Eidetic.
I'm not. I'm close, but not quite.
Wow. That's a great, mm-hmm. That is a great case.
And it's lots of fun. It's very dangerous. Because you get to know who's telling you the truth. And you pay very close attention. That whole psychology thing, you know, people, when you were a double minority, you listen very carefully. So if somebody makes an anti-Semitic comment without knowing, you bury that. It's in your head now. And you can have fun with it. You can either trip them up again and then insult them, or you can just let it sit. And at some point, at your convenience, say, oh, by the way, I'm Jewish. And they pull way back. That's great manipulation. The other is the gay thing. So you're listening. Little things that are said, watch people's eyes, who they follow when somebody walks in the room.
Gaydar.
Yeah. Gaydar. You just have it.
I think in my lifetime, Stephen, the biggest changes I've seen, one, are in gay rights, mm-hmm. because As you know, my mother was Kenneth Smith's talent agent, and I, gays have gone from my, this horrible being yelled at to gay, I was at the first gay marriage in Dufferin County. Mm-hmm. That is the evolution of women's rights, but
right.
gay rights, Mike, in your lifetime,
so fast, it was
extraordinary.
And I remember a cousin of mine used to say, all you need for acceptance is to have an outsider of extraordinary importance say how wonderful you are. And during the AIDS crisis, it never stopped with Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah.
And from one after the other after the other, and it was during that time that everybody sort of did the job. They were all people. And it was a horrible time, but if you looked at what was going to come as a result, it was a good time.
How would you like to be remembered? How would you like people to think of you?
I hope. Witty, kind, and caring.
Huh?
And sometimes really sarcastic and bitchy, but, once you get to know him, he's a good guy. Yeah.
I started by saying when I first met you, I realized you were a New York Jewish gay intellectual mm-hmm. with a quick wit, and I had to get to know that man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to end this by, you are definitely one of the people that I would say is worth knowing, Mr. Stephen Adler.
Very kind to me. Thank you. Thank you.
I cut it off.